How do you pronounce it? Back to you.
Pronounce what? Triton? You're saying, is that what you're saying? Or something else? You're saying Triton, like a tree. It's Triton, like the word I, like me and I. You know, it's Triton. I'm not sure if that's what you were saying or something else. Back to you.
Thank you very much, Triton. No, I was asking about the proper pronunciation of Kepler, belt. Back to you.
Yeah, the Kuiper belt. Yeah, named after Kuiper. He was the one that predicted all these trillions of objects in the air, in the outer solar system beyond Pluto. And since then, we've found Kuiper belt objects that are bigger than the moon of Pluto. So there's a lot of weird things out there, good sized objects. And my guess is Triton was one of them and somehow got pulled into the solar system either by the sun or by an interaction with another Kuiper object or something. There's also a theory that, you know, at one time there might have been a massive object even further out, maybe even a star, and that might have affected some of the gravitational movements of things in the Kuiper belt, you know, which, you know, gets things going. We have some comets that come in from out there. Or asteroids coming in from out there that were originally part of it, and now they're in prominent orbit around the sun, like Halley's Comet. It's one of them. Back you with.
We have a short time. I have actually a question in the area of speculation. If Triton starts to orbit closer to Neptune over the next millions of years, could the tidal forces cause Triton to heat up more, and there will be the liquid nitrogen seas again, because it is assumed that the Triton had a long time ago an ocean of nitrogen there. Back to you.
I can't speculate on that one. I don't know. The nitrogen came from somewhere. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. Awful lot of nitrogen. A lot of nitrogen on Titan. On Triton. And also Titan, by the way. Titan, moon around Saturn. That whole thing is, sucked in, you know. The whole planet, the whole moon of Titan is that atmosphere is like, I think, like 90% or more nitrogen. So nitrogen is a big thing out in the outer planet.
Okay, N2HCN, I believe I have a last subject to discuss. Navigation systems competing with traditionally American GPS. So there is a Galileo system, global navigation satellite system created by European Union. They wanted to be independent from United States. So there is a European Space Agency, ECA, that is actually responsible for that, and it is headquartered in Prague, Czechia. And I believe in Germany they have the center responding to the correction of time. So the Galileo system has a greater accuracy than GPS. And listen to that, 1.6 centimeters to 2.3 centimeters accuracy. Unbelievable. It is unbelievable. So, comparing to the a GPS a few meters in a circle, I've read different kind of information sending from 1 meter, minus, plus, but this one is in centimeters. Dr. Roy, you want to comment on it?
AC2GS, nothing much to say. I mean, the more time goes by, the better electronics, the better timekeeping, and so the specs will keep on improving. It's only a matter of time that Europe wanted to have their own, just in case. I wonder, do the Chinese have any plans for their own GPS system? I know Russia has it, we have it, now Europe has it. Does China have it?
As far as I know, Russia has a GLONASS system, and China doesn't have one. The Galileo is a highly precision positioning system. It was a lot of problem with that. They have right now a 24 satellites, if I remember correctly, and they're launching right now the new series of modified satellites. So it looks like if we don't do something, that everybody's gonna switch to the European one. Although there is a joint work being done on having both of those systems working together. The only thing is that the frequency of European system is about 1600 megahertz, and I'm not sure what frequency our GPS system works at. Dr. Roy.
Well, I mean,
WS2N. Yeah, China's got them, by the way, Roy.
Oh, yeah, okay. I don't see it in the news, but I don't see a lot of Chinese stuff in the news that we should. But, yeah, ultimately it will depend upon commercial interest. Someone will build they've already built a chip for the European version, but they'll build a dual chip so that you'll be able to select both, sample from both. Give it enough time, and there'll be a dual chip from a couple of manufacturers. And then they'll get it all figured out.
Paul, you say they have, how do they call that system, Chinese system? Because I didn't hear about it.
Yeah, it's easy if you remember the BDS system, Bravo, Delta, Sierra. BDS, Beidou, I think is the way they pronounce it, Beidou. It's just another name for, it's the Chinese name for the Big Dipper. And if you know about astronomy, Big Dipper is the clue, you know, where you would go to try to figure out where the North Star is. And so that's the reason they chose that, the Beidou system. I think they got, I don't know, a dozen satellites up there or so, but they got plans of putting, like, countless satellites up there. We won't be able to see the stars soon, I guess. Between them and then the Jeff Bezos wants to put them up there. 3,000 or more satellites. They're going to be called Kuiper too, named after. Oh, by the way, so you got the Jeff Bezos Kuiper. Satellites are going to be going up. He's already got contracts with different rocket companies to put these things up, including his own. So, you know, so that's all. He's got a couple up there already that he tested out. It worked very well. Anyway, I guess over to you, Roy. WS2S.
Thank you. You know, it's interesting. I think about a week or two, the New York Times had this beautiful animated graphic of all the crap that we have circling the Earth. all the junk, the satellites that work, the satellites that don't work, the scrap metal that's just circling us. And I tried to cut and paste it and put it in my link page, but unfortunately the New York Times was too clever for me. They don't allow such things. It's probably some kind of a Java applet going on their newspaper page. But, I mean, it was amazing to look at all the junk that's surrounding this planet of ours.
Yeah, I've heard that...
Did they say 100,000 things, not necessarily all satellites, you know, junk? I've heard that number thrown out there before.
How do you call it? Roy, not Roy. bunch of satellites, bunch of D-Star, the Starlings, the scientists wouldn't be able to see the planets soon. Back to you.
Yeah, that's been an ongoing complaint of astronomers that they don't really like to see. You know, every day it seems someone else is announcing that they're going to launch thousands more satellites. And I don't care if you color them black. I don't care what kind of voodoo spell you use on them. You know, if it comes a time that there's 100,000 satellites in orbit, it's going to make astronomy much more difficult. And, you know, astronomers being astronomers are more interested in looking at the stars than looking at all these damn satellites. So it's going to be a problem. I mean, it might not be a problem where there's a catastrophe that one satellite bangs into another, on and on it goes. Because, you know, space is kind of big. But still, just for visual observation, it's going to make life more difficult. It's just a given. You know, so I don't know how the scientific community is going to deal with this ultimately. I guess it's a political question, and that means that astronomers don't have a voice, really.
Okay, so there is another one, magnetic navigation. It is used mostly by military. It is alternative to GPS that harness Earth magnetic field. It uses magnetometers and magnetic anomaly maps to estimate location. And the system has been tested in flight and offers benefits over traditional navigation methods. So the system, it is being called MagNav, and it's a heavy cooperation with Massachusetts famous educational facility, Cambridge, and Air Force Lab, Air Force Institute of Technology, Autonomy and Navigation Center, Travis Air Force Base, and whatsoever. I'm just thinking. The swarm of a big drones that appears to be in New Jersey and various places. If they use this system, let's say, and it's like a test to find out how they behave. Back to you, Dr. Ray.
Again, because I don't have any intelligence clearance, I don't have a clue. They could be using GPS. They could be using anything. The magnetic method is primarily, I think, was initially designed so that geolocation is not jammable magnetically. You know, given enough technology, you can jam the RF signals of every GPS satellite. But you can't jam a magnetic field. So this is a method to get around an adversary that practices GPS jamming.
Okay. Paul, do you have a comment?
Okay. I haven't heard that one yet. Although, you know, I have a good GPS system here. It's 60 years old, that never needs batteries, it never breaks, and it still works. It's my old compass from when I was a Boy Scout West. Hi, back to you.
Yeah, but Paul, you have to sometimes factor in the correction because magnetic north is not stable. It's moving.
About 12 degrees off true north, I know.
Yeah, but it's not stationary there. It's a moving object, unfortunately. And I think the government had to update their readings for people using compasses and such because it's kind of taken up a little bit faster pace of moving about. So can't depend on magnetic north being at the magnetic pole. And you can't depend upon it being any particular place over time. You know, that's an object that changes over time, not phases.
Okay, sounds good. Well, I'll use my compass and I'll look at the moss on the tree, and I know which side the moss grows. But, you know, I'll combine the two, and with that, I'll be able to get to the grocery store, I guess. Back to you.
Okay, very good. So you used to be a Boy Scout?
Yes, I did. Absolutely. Very good. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, well, it never leaves you. That's good. It's good knowledge. Anyway, thank you, Wes. I assume we're done for tonight?
Yes, say a few words from you. It's going to take you 1 minute because you're much better in English. About Cinnabar, and what we get the mercury from, and that weird behavior of gallium indium tin compound called gallistein. It's up to you. Thank you very much, and I appreciate a chance given to me and to Exia.
Well, thank you, Wesley. I'll just say a few words. I won't kind of go into the whole video because, you know, he kind of, the premise of a video that was Wes saw and sent me a copy of is that a liquid metal will find its way through a maze. But if you watch what he does is every time it gets stuck, he pushes it back into the path. So it wasn't really the liquid metal that found the way out of the maze. It was the guy doing the YouTube video, and he let the liquid metal sheet. Cinnabar, very fascinating, interesting thing. It's a red mineral. It's basically mercury sulfide. If you take mercury sulfide and you heat it, the sulfur goes into sulfur oxide into a gas, and you're left with elemental mercury. Which is has fascinated mankind for millennia. It's a metal that is liquid at room temperature. Alchemists regularly included it as part of the ingredients in turning lead to gold. And there's a rumor, I don't know if it's been proven or not, that an emperor in China was buried in a pool of mercury for some reason. Unfortunately, although mercury was ubiquitous, anyone who had a thermometer had mercury, mercury can be toxic. Metallic mercury, per se, is not terribly toxic, but anything organic, including a mercury, can do devilish things to a human body. So most people don't play around with liquid mercury. Instead, there's an alloy of gallium, indium, and tin that is liquid at room temperature, that isn't toxic, that you can play with if you're so inclined to play with metals that are liquid at room temperature. So I think I'll leave it at that for the time being. I'll thank everyone that participated tonight. I hope you'll join us next Sunday at 8 when we try and do this all over again, preferably without a French discussion of weather in Canada. So thanks, everyone. I'll be back a little later. Now it's time for Paul, WS2N, with the SpaceNet Report.
Okay, thanks, Roy. And two things that I saved, well, I cherished anyway from the Boy Scouts was the compass and the straight key that we used to play with. But that straight key got lost in the movement of stuff over the years. So I wound up eventually replacing that straight key with a Radio Shack straight key. So I had to have the straight key. Anyway, Blue Origin still plans on launching their New Glenn rocket far from Launch Complex 36, and they plan on doing it by the end of the month. I just don't, I don't think they're going to make it. I think they're going to get close. I'm going to predict January, although I hope they make it by the end of the year. The New Glenn rocket is competition for SpaceX with their Falcon 9. This thing that Jeff Bezos plans on launching is about twice the thrust of the Falcon 9, and they plan on having it completely reusable. Well, not the second stage, but the first stage will come down on a drone ship for now, and. And, it's going to be a big step forward if they can get this thing off the ground. They tried to do it back in October, but things got delayed. They just weren't ready. And they planned on their first launch was going to be sending two satellites to Mars. But that was a little concerning for NASA. They didn't want to put hypergolic fuel into those satellites early, and then find out that it was going to be delayed for an extended period of time. So they just pulled that mission, and they are delaying that to the second launch of the New Glenn whenever that occurs, and that'll probably be in the springtime. So that Mars mission will eventually take off. And because they're small satellites, they're able to make up the difference for the time that it's going to take to get to Mars. It usually takes, 6 to 8 months to get to Mars when the planets are aligned, close to one another, which takes place roughly every 26 months. But they're going to have to probably wait until springtime. And they're able to actually have a different kind of orbit. Probably use an Earth gravitational assist, or they worked out a different plan to actually still get these two satellites to Mars. And because they are on the lighter side, they're able to, they'll have that enough fuel to push us into whatever orbit that they're looking at. So the first mission is they're going to have like this ring that's built by Blue Origin, and that's going to be able to attach many, many satellites to it. And once into orbit, they could use it as a transporter to transport countless satellites into different orbits. They'll use that. They want to test that piece of equipment anyway, so they need to get this thing in the air and back on the ground to see if it could be reused. They're going to start from day one to try to make this thing reusable. And if they do, it'll be remarkable. SpaceX tried it in the beginning, and they lost I don't know how many boosters until they were able to do it. Probably 6 to 8 boosters, I guess, before they were able to land one on a drone properly. So we'll see. I think it's almost 4 million pounds of thrust. The Falcon 9 has 1.7 million pounds of thrust. this is a monster. It's you know, as tall as, almost as tall as the Saturn V rockets from years ago. If you were to lay the rocket down on the ground, it would be the length of a football field. So, should be great once they get this thing going. They spent a lot of money, billions of dollars, to refurbish the launch complex down in Florida at LC-36. I think they're going to do it. I saw a documentary on it, I don't know, a couple months ago. It looks like they're in good shape. Right now, I think they're actually waiting for the okay from the government, which, of course, SpaceX goes through that all the time, you know. I think it's pretty much happening with Blue Origin as well. They don't need to be okay. So when they plan on launch, they don't have a date yet, of course. I would definitely announce that. And then they need everything to go in their favor. They need good weather at the launch complex. They need good weather where the drone ship is going to be. That means, you know, no tidal waves going by. They need good seas. So good upper level winds. Sometimes you can get 100 mile an hour plus winds up in the upper levels. They have that. They all they always cancel. They have to hope that somebody is in a boat isn't floating around out there downrange. They always look for that. Coast Guard has to chase people away. And we'll see. Any comments? WS2F. Okay, nothing hard. Moving on topic, I wanted to talk about this, I think last week. There's a spacecraft out at the L1 position, at Lagrange Point 1. I mean, it's roughly a million miles away from Earth, in the direction of the sun, so it's not really orbiting the Earth. Just orbiting the sun, but it follows the Earth around, so it always stays roughly 1 million miles away from the Earth. And the name of this spacecraft is the Solar Dynamics Observatory. It's been up there for quite a few years. It's always sending great information back they call it an observatory on Earth, and it flooded this observatory. That's where they keep all the electronics, all the data that comes back from the Solar Dynamics Observatory. And the observatory right now was flooded a couple of weeks ago. It had a cooling pipe break. So that knocked them offline for quite a while. But I just read that they are now back online. But, you think that a spacecraft is, has got possible problems, with radiation and affecting the different things on a spacecraft. You wouldn't think that on Earth you have a part of a building that gets flooded out with water. I think it got into one or two of the servers, and they had to shut everything down and lose all this information that the scientists love to get week in, week out. Well, it looks good now. From what I see, naturally they fixed the cooling pipe that burst. I was trying to look to see how big the diameter was of the pipe. Why it caused such a big flood, but I can't find that information. So, any comments? WS2F. Okay, and it looks like SpaceX is going to eventually get the seventh star Starship off the ground from Boca Chica, Texas. But they're working on some changes. They thought they were going to have a launch probably this month, but that doesn't look like that's going to get off the ground until next. So we'll see. I understand that one's not going to go into orbit yet either, but I thought it was. And that's the way they do things. You know, they constantly launch rockets and they find all the different problems with it after they launch, and they make repairs. They do another launch. And NASA cannot afford to work that way. But the congressman would say, hey, we're not spending money to watch your rockets blow up. So NASA's way around it is they develop all this test equipment. I mean, highfalutin test equipment for everything. The metallurgy and wind tunnels and all kinds of test equipment that have been developed. Gigantic rooms that they could pull a vacuum down. They could duplicate the environment of space in many cases. And I think it's good because there's a lot of technology that comes off of just developing all this test equipment, that eventually winds up in the, out in the commercial world anyway. So I believe in that system, and we'll see. And Jeff Bezos, by the way, with his new Glenn rocket, he kind of system as well. He plans on testing so much over the last, I don't know how many years, it's got to be 10 years working on this one rocket to put it in, into space. And he's run a lot of different tests and right here on Earth. And I think he's going to make it. I think it's going to launch. And then it's going to come down and land on the drone. He named the drone after his mother, which I thought was nice. Jacqueline is the name of the drone. And it's much bigger, by the way, than the drones that SpaceX use, which you really need. This is a much bigger rocket than what SpaceX catches. He lands the Falcon 9 boosters. This is going to be the new Glenn booster. Anyway, any comments? WS2N.
Kilo Echo 2, Alpha Juliet Uniform. Paul, this is Charlie.
K2, AJU. Hi, Charlie. And how are you? And comments? And by the way, I looked up to see if there was going to be any Mars launches in the next month. And I don't see anything like that. I know you were talking about that. I think what you were looking at is what they were planning on doing would have been a Mars launch early. But like I mentioned earlier tonight, that Mars mission was not scrubbed, just delayed until probably early spring. My guess is probably March or April. Back to you, Charlie.
Yep. Now, the Starship, the prototype now, how much better is this one than its predecessor?
The Starship that they're building now compared to the Falcon that SpaceX keeps launching?
Yes.
Yeah, of course, the big difference. First of all, the fuels that they use are going to be different. The Falcon 9 uses the kerosene and liquid oxygen. The new Starship uses methane and liquid oxygen on both stages, the main booster stage and the Starship itself, which is really the upper stage. Both liquid methane, liquid oxygen on those stages. So there's a difference. The fuel, the engines themselves, they call them the Miranda D engines on the Falcon 9 rocket. I think I got the wrong name. Not Miranda. Let me think. Every time. Those engines are what, about 150,000 pounds for each. They have 9 of them, so you add them up and they wind up with 1.7 million pounds of thrust. So that's what you have for Falcon. The Starship has the Raptor engines. Oh, by the way, it's the Merlin. Merlin engines is what the Falcon uses, but the Starship uses the Raptor engines, which are much more powerful. They're around, let's call it 500,000 pounds of thrust each, so each one is much more powerful. On top of that, instead of running 9 engines on the booster stage, they're running 33 engines on the booster stage. So developing, I think, up to 18 million pounds of thrust. Which is, that would be at their high level. So you could wind up with, over twice the amount of thrust than you would have gotten on an old Saturn V rocket that NASA used to launch to the moon. So the amount of thrust, the ratio between the two, let's average it out. Call it 2 million for Falcon, and let's call it 16 million for the other one. So you 8 times more thrust at liftoff. So, and that, the height's going to be, you're looking at 250 feet or so for the Falcon 9. And this thing's, twice the height, almost, about 400 feet tall. Diameter on the Falcon is, I think, and the diameter on the new Starship is, I think 23 feet. Falcon 9 has come back and landed either on land or drone ships, coming close to 400. One of their boosters that now have been reused 25 times. That was the other day. So that thing, in the news, 25 times on one booster. The Starship, of course, nothing has been reused yet. So far, they've only caught one of them. It's not going to land on a drone ship. They're going to come back to you where they launched from. And they have these big arms that are going to catch the booster. And that has been done once. The Starship itself, which is like the upper stage, eventually is supposed to come back and, I guess, also be caught by some kind of arm system. We'll see. He thinks he's going to be launching, hundreds of these things a year sometime. But I think we've got a long way, long, long way before that happens. Let me drop it. Falcon 9 has turned out to be a very reliable rocket. Like I said, probably almost coming up to almost 400 launches. The combination of Falcon 9, and that could be converted to the Falcon Heavy, which is every time they launch one of those, it's like taking three boosters and putting them together. Starship is not designed to do that. It's just going to be one big booster, 33 engines, and then the second stage is going to have the same engines, but it's going to have six engines on the second stage, and three regular Raptor engines, each one with 500,000 pounds of thrust, and then another three engines also with the same engines, but there's a difference because they're optimized vacuum. You'll notice that by these big bells, these big nozzles coming off of the off of three of them. So when you see the three nozzles that are so big on any vehicle compared to the smaller nozzles, you know, it could be the same size engines, but that's how you can tell the difference between a vacuum operated engine and a non-vacuum vacuum engine. Anyway, Charlie, that's the best I could do. Back to you. WS2N. KU2AJU, any further comments? WS2N.
What happens, I dropped the microphone by accident. I'm gonna stop right now.
Okay. Better than what I used to do. When I got one of my radios, I pick it up with my right hand and my left hand, myself talking into the back of the microphone. What am I doing? Anyway, there's another mission I'm following. I'd like to see this thing get off the ground. And this is a combination of NASA and the Indian Space Program. They have it's going to be they call it a SAR, Synthetic Aperture Radar mission. They teamed up with India to do this. It's going to be launched from one of their rockets, not ours. We're contributing parts of this spacecraft, and India's got part of it. And what it is a radar mission that's going to look at the climate of Earth. Massive antenna. It's a 50-foot diameter antenna. Or when you read about it, they say it's a 12-meter antenna. But roughly a 50-foot antenna. And it's a pretty large satellite that's attached to this thing. It's got this big boom that comes straight up above the satellite. That's where the LND is, the low noise detector for the system. It's not gonna, it's really a dish antenna, so it's going to be a reflector, and it's going to be able to transmit and receive signals as it bounces off the ground and creates a swath around the Earth as it goes. It's going to be looking at the ice on the Earth and the mountains and the water levels and different scientific stuff they're going to get off of this antenna as it goes around the Earth. But, naturally the reason I'm interested in it is because of its launch vehicle. Launch vehicle is going to be a geosynchronous satellite launch vehicle. They call it the GSLV. That's a heavy lift vehicle India uses. There's They also use another one called the PSLV, the Polar Satellite Launch Vehicle. That's a medium lift rocket that they use. This is going to be, you know, they're going to use the heavy one, the big unit and big satellite and its massive antenna. It was supposed to launch, oh, many months ago, I guess last spring, but the engineers figured out that after launch, they predicted that the antenna itself, well, the linkages and all that, was going to get too hot and possibly caused them problems, I guess, when they deployed it. So they scrubbed the mission. They actually packed up the antenna and the whole satellite, put it all back on one of these cargo planes, flew it all the way back to California, and let them work on it again to try to correct this linkage problem. And they figured out all they had to do is put some kind of reflective tape on all of these links, these rods that are connecting the antenna. And this way it will reflect the heat. Talking about Wesley's earlier conversation about shiny objects, you know, reflecting the heat away. And that's what they plan on doing. And it's all already done. And now they're just waiting for the manifest, because there's other launches that India has. They're going to wait for the launch pad to be clear. These things launch from southeast India. And, oh, you know, looking to see this get up in the air. If you want to look it up, it's called the NISAR, NISAR, which is the stands for the NASA India. SAR is Synthetic Aperture Radar, so NISAR, and we'll see how it goes. I mean, it's so big, you know, they had to put it on a C-130 cargo vehicle to fly this thing back and forth. So now it looks like they're going to fly it back to India and eventually get it ready for launch. So, you know, I saw pictures of what it's supposed to look like, and this antenna is large. They've done this type of thing before, but the vehicle itself is also, when I say vehicle, the spacecraft itself is also very large. So it should be good. I like to see that, you know, NASA is getting involved with India now on a regular basis. I don't know if it's going to continue in the future. I'm worried about canceling a lot of missions, you know, especially climate missions. But this one's, you know, this one's in the books. This one's already signed off. They won't be able to cancel this. You know, unfortunately, that's what happens every time you change different administrations. You know, you go from Republican to Democrat, back and forth. They tend to cancel missions and change things. They find it hard to do with like the manned space program, because you have literally dozens of states across the country that are involved with the manned space program, and nobody wants to cut their budget in their state. So, you know, they don't want to lay people off. So I think manned space program, I think it's good to go. But I worry about the science missions, you know, the robotic missions to different planets. I worry about Dragonfly. Dragonfly is supposed to be going to, we talked about Titan before, you know, not Triton, but Titan around Saturn. They have the Dragonfly mission scheduled to go there in a few years. So I hope that one, you know, gets funded enough where they can't back out. So we'll see. The synthetic aperture radar mission operates on two bands, the L band and the S band. S band is two to 4 gigahertz roughly, and the L band is one to 2 gigahertz. So I'll be transmitting and receiving on those bands as it goes around the earth. Both countries have contributed to the development of those transmitters and receivers. You know, that's like a couple of $1 billion mission for the NISAR mission. ISAR. Any comments? WSWAP. Okay, nothing heard. I did bring up this China thing. I think they have 18 satellites already in space for the BDS missions, the Beidou system. So, we'll see. I did bring that up before. I just saw it. So I can confirm that China does have some satellites up there for GPS. Got the Galileo system. They have quite a few satellites for Galileo. They've been launched by the Ariane rockets down in French Guiana quite a bit. Years ago, before the Ukraine war, they were launching on Soyuz rockets that were actually launching out of South America, French Guiana. They had a launch complex and everything for the Soyuz rockets. So a couple of them went up on that. But since the war, no more Soyuz launches from French Guiana to the European Space Agency. You know, it was weird. The European Space Agency was buying up rockets, you know, from Russia, and they had people over there helping them, you know, with the launch complex to do that. But now that all went away. So now Ariane 5 is gone, and now Ariane 6 is now replaced 5. So they're trying to get the manifest going on that. On the Ariane 6, by the way, they have contracts with Jeff Bezos to also launch the Kuiper Internet constellation using the Ariane 6 rocket. Bezos also has contracts with the Americans, with Lockheed and Boeing, with their Vulcan rocket. So there's dozens of launches planned on that. Plus, they're going to use their own New Glenn rocket to launch their Kuiper satellites as well. In total, there's already, I think, 60 launches planned just to put the Jeff Bezos Kuiper Internet satellites into space. So, interesting times ahead. We'll see how, you know, if half of this stuff goes up that I've been talking about, it's still going to be a lot of launches, a lot of work, and a good future for the technically inclined people that follow the space program. With that, I'm going to close, Roy. A couple of minutes left, but I'm out of topics, and we'll be on tomorrow night. Let me drop it. We'll try to be on for the ClubNet, which is always very informative, and that's always followed by Swap and Chop, and that's followed by Newsline. So I hope to be on for that, and just thank Lou for working on the system, trying to clear up the interference that we had earlier tonight. Anyway, over to you, Roy, AC2GS, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report. Thanks for letting me do this. Back to you, Roy.
And NY2H with a comment.
Comment away, Lou.
email. I sent the individuals in Canada. I went to their website and scraped off about 5 email addresses of some of their officers and technical people. One of them bounced, but I think the other ones all went through. And I CC'd you on it, so I just advised them of what was going on. And I went on Plainview and connected to the New England reflector, and yeah, they're still spouting the weather, so I guess until they disconnect, it's going to occur. And I think, as you said, they're irregular. They connect weekly to us. I guess that's automated. I don't know. And now maybe they automated the weather, which they talk about weather on their website. And maybe they did the 2 things at once and they weren't supposed to. But anyway, hopefully they'll be advised and they'll rectify the situation.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Lou. I really do appreciate it. Yeah, they're on autopilot. They come on at 8:30, and they leave. They used to leave at 10:30.
Time.
And then, for some reason, they changed the programming, and it was 11, and sometimes it was past 11. So they may have just forgotten about the old programming and added additional weather links, not realizing what would happen. You know, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. But I thank you very much, Lou. We appreciate all that you do for us.
Sure. And by the way, I just got an automated response because one of the addresses was help at b3lsr.ca, and it says, just confirming that we got your request, we're on it. So I guess that's good.
Yeah. I mean, you know, an auto response is better than no response. But again, I tend to give people the benefit of the doubt. So they probably just screwed up their programming because all this is not. I don't think any of this is done by a real human being. It's too punctual. So they just have a set of criteria that go into the programming, and they probably screwed up their programming this Sunday.
Yeah, I suppose so. And, yeah, good evening, Paul, also. And, Roy, if you got 5 minutes, we can maybe do a chat on the phone, a quick 5-minute chat.
Sure. As soon as I get off of this, feel free. You have my phone number?
Yes.
Okay. Just as soon as I get off, I'll be more than happy to have a chat.
All right, I'm NY2H, it's clear.
Okie doke. Well, many thanks to Lou. Many thanks to you, Paul, for the SpaceNet report, for all the help with the technical net, and all that you do for the club. I really do appreciate it. And I appreciate everyone who participates here. You are the guys that make or break this technical net. It's not a broadcast. It's not a show. It's not a monologue. It's an interaction of human beings. And I hope the people who listened learned a few things or at least got a little entertained. And as always, I like to leave people with the usual stuff. Dick, K2RW, may rest in peace. He used to end his technical nets with the advice to be kind to each other, and that's always good advice. We're coming up to the holiday season. I hope everyone has a great Christmas and a great Hanukkah and a happy, a healthy New Year. But be kind to each other because this world is going a little bit crazy. So we all have to be a little bit uncrazy to kind of deal with it all. Anyway, then, of course, good old Epictetus. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So keep your mind open, but not so wide open that your brain falls out. We wouldn't want that to happen to anyone here. And as always, have a great week. Stay safe. Be well. And please, if you can, join me next Sunday at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. This is AC2GS, and I will be clear after I say, slap.
I heard was Solaris. This is KUCGFO.